From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The G20 has opened in Osaka, Japan. President Trump is in attendance, as is President Xi Jinping of China and President Vladimir Putin of Russia, among many others. To work through some of the issues facing everyone at the G20, we spoke with international affairs expert Mark Sloboda via Skype from Moscow Friday. So the eyes of the world are on Osaka, Japan. Trump and Putin sat down on the same stage. Trump didn't punch him in the face. They laughed with each other and apparently were cordial to each other, which has, of course, the Twitterverse going bananas. Michael McFaul and a bunch of other characters are ready to start screaming treason again. President Putin did this interview with the Financial Times. Everybody's looking at Japan and China, making deals, a whole lot of stuff going on. Maybe you could parse some of it for us, Mark.
Sure, Don, thanks for having me on. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
Our pleasure.
This is once again the world leaders of the major 20 industrial economies plus sundry others that are invited along as head of institutions or for kicks and giggles are meeting in Osaka, Japan. Mostly for photo ops and handshaking sessions. I mean, that's let's be honest. A G20 meeting today is only marginally more useful than G7 or G8 meetings were,
right?
A decade ago, which is to say, not much, right?
Right. I mean, staffers have been working, whatever issues there are worked on more or less constantly by people that do that kind of work. This is kind of...
Yeah, experts.
Yeah, exactly.
Specialists, right?
Right?
Yeah. Right? This is... A chance for, because face-to-face meetings between leaders still matter, this is, because of personal relations, this gets, 30 or 40 of the most important players of the world all together where they can have short, brief, bilateral meetings and handshakes and get the feel of each other. And then possibly that will, the idea is that that will drive towards some future bilateral or other developments where something real is actually done.
Right.
But, this Osaka, like the last G20 meeting in Argentina in November, is completely overshadowed by Trump, right? This is Trump's show, right? And everyone is coming to play Trump's show. I would say probably 70 to 75% of Trump's show is domestic politics and Trump looking at re-election and what he wants from each player towards his attempt at re-election, which I don't actually think he has a good chance, but we'll see. I didn't think he would win in the first place either, so, who am I to say on
right.
that?
Right, what he did, right.
And maybe the other 25 to 30% is Trump's take on geopolitics, which is heavily influenced by his take on geoeconomics, more particularly.
Agreed.
With his businessman background. So what everyone is looking at with this, I mean, there's a number of crises going on in the world. The first and foremost, when you think of the G20, is, of course, the economic war that Trump is waging on the world, right? I mean, particularly China, right, with the tariffs war, the escalations, and Trump now kicking out Huawei and ZTE and blocking China from supercomputer chip purchases and everything. It's escalating into a huge tech geoeconomic trade war,
right?
That is probably dominating. That is the big thing overshadowing the G20. at stake here is not whether this matter will be resolved. Of course, it's not going to be. Certainly not at the G20, and probably not at all in the near future. But the question simply whether Trump immediately after the G20 meeting will raise tariffs on China by another $300 billion or so on whatever we have, whatever is left untariffed at this point between from trade from China to the U.S. And of course, China's almost what will be immediate and inevitable return fire on tariffs on U.S. goods to China.
Right. And you want to say that number things. Again? $300 billion.
We're more.
Talking huge. More. These things are historically unprecedented.
Yeah. I mean, it is big, right? And that's on top of what has already been done. And
right.
With this, essentially everything from China. And of course, the reality is that tariffs placed on Chinese good will be mostly paid by who?
Right.
The U.S. consumer.
Right. Consumers, yep.
Right. Because U.S. consumption, maintaining that barely middle class living standard, that working Americans do, is only possible because of cheap Chinese consumer goods, right? I mean that's the devil's trade.
Yeah. Now, trade-off. Let me point something out because of what you just said, which means essentially that these tariffs are, and because now Trump has said, hey, I could live with if we have to keep these tariffs in place forever, I can live with that because the government's doing very well with the money we're taking in. And yeah. And so they're looking at some of the things that he'd like to pay for, but you can't raise taxes for. Well, suddenly, actually, it's a massive tax increase. And, the tax cuts that he did last year, you're looking at starting to offset the lost revenue simply with this tariff revenue. And so what it is, even though they don't listed as a tax at the cash register at Walmart or whatever, that is, in essence, the U.S. government reaching in and taking a sales tax on all of the goods from China and using that money, throwing that money into the general fund.
Sure. It's an additional huge sales tax.
Exactly. Yep.
Yep. Now, the reason Trump, I believe, is going to increase tariffs, whether it's done immediately after this meeting or he waits a few months to give diplomacy a chance to fail again. Trump is not necessarily looking for a big victory and a compromise here. What Trump sees and what every other president has seen this is there's a huge trade imbalance, right, between not just the U.S. and China, but growing between the U.S. and most of the rest of the world. There's a huge trade imbalance between the U.S. and Russia. Despite Obama's right. talk right. about, oh, Russia doesn't produce anything, the U.S. Purchased something like 10 times more from Russia than Russia does from the U.S.
Right.
Americans have a really a skewed economy, and they built a global neoliberal capitalist and financial architecture for the world, which did make the rest of the world play their game.
Right.
But by the rules of that game, with the free movement of capital and financial deregulation, allowed a shift of economic power from West to East,
right,
and this is what China took advantage of and rose. Russia has taken a little bit more modest growth from it and reemerged, not as a superpower at all, but at least as a great power and certainly a dominating regional power, and numerous other countries. I mean, Indonesia has become, and India have both become, serious countries of note as a result of this, and of course the huge growth of wealth of the Gulf Arabs, which are generally foreign policy aligned with the U.S. So this has all emerged. And the U.S. sees no way to reverse this, right? And the result of that is that, and it is generally what we talk about as globalization, right? We always talk about globalization, that it's plus plus. Well, that's just blatantly false. And then the easiest way to see that is in, you know, the U.S. and in the EU right now, what they call the rise of populist politics. And what it actually is you know, the people who lost from globalization, i.e. the non-cosmopolitan elites, you know, the previous working class industrial jobs, the blue collar, the Rust Belt, in the UK, it's Northern England with the old manufacturing center and so on. These are the people who lost from globalization and saw no chance of recovery. And Trump arose in the US and Brexit rose in the UK. We've seen the rise of populist politics across Europe and Italy with this coalition government between the far right and the far left decimating the old center right and center left parties. We see the rise of Marine Le Pen in France, her party is now polling higher than Macron's centrist party. It's a backlash, right? Not only, of course, against the economic effects of this neoliberal globalization,
but
also
that.
Due to the cultural effects, right?
Yeah.
Which is primarily to do with migration, immigration, which has neoliberal rationales for it, as well as classical liberal rationales for it, right? Economic as well as postmodern liberal rationales for it. Also, I think a bit of blowback against the identity wars, the really pushing the LGBT identity agenda, perhaps too strong, too quickly. Against traditional values in other countries, that plays into it as well. But you can't neglect the economic aspect of it all. Trump sees that there's no easy way for the U.S. to restore these trade imbalances, and that which means the U.S. will keep losing money, the national debt will keep growing, and the U.S.'s place in the world will eventually start to weaken as the economy compares and decreases in relative terms. The military will follow, as will the use of the dollar as a reserve currency.
Right.
So U.S.'s, controlling grip on the international financial system. Trump sees all that going away, and he's picking a fight with China, but also to a lesser extent with the rest of the world now, and says, this idea of free trade, which was never really free anyway, it was always negotiated terms of trade. We're done with this game. We're going to rewrite the rules of the game that are better in our balance, and we're going to do it now. We're going to do it quick. We're going to do it dirty and hard with blackmail and threats and economic war and real war where that fails, while we can still do it, because that window where we're capable of it is closing. And this geoeconomic aspect ties into Trump's own base, how he was elected and him looking at re-election. And he's got to go back to his voters in 2020 without any big change in their lives. Right. The stock market might be doing well, but that doesn't say anything about the living standards of working and middle class Americans. What does he say to them? Well, he's got to be able to say, I'm fighting for you. I'm fighting a trade war with China for you. And it doesn't make any difference whether he wins that war and he gets a compromise where China backs down, right? And accepts new terms of global trade on the US's Trump will inevitably build as Trump's grand deal or something like that. Or if it's just a state of conflict and hostility, that also suits Trump just as well. But that's what he needs to bring into re-election. That's his view of the world. And that's why nothing is going to be settled in Osaka or likely beyond, unless China is completely willing to kowtow and give in to U.S. demands. And in case anyone didn't realize it, China has its own domestic politics, its own sense of national pride,
right.
And its leaders will face repercussions no matter what they do, whether they change their economics, accept the grand deal and lesser economics, which will reduce China's growth inevitably and their profits, which will hurt the Chinese wage increases and living standards increases, which is billed as the grand bargain with the Chinese people, they will have to accept, the national humiliation of accepting what is essentially blackmail demands from a trade war posited by Trump. And let's not forget that going into this G20 meeting, when the Chinese president hadn't even indicated for sure whether he was coming or not, Trump outright said that the Chinese leader will appear. He ordered him to appear, or Trump would immediately
impose more sanctions.
Increase yep. the tariffs.
That's
and
right.
that's just, it's amazing. I guess the Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, kind of gracefully ignored that
right.
and came anyway. But
said,
it almost made it hard for him to come.
Almost made it impossible.
If the U.S. leader is demanding that you come, well, it's you have to accept
right.
under certain terms that he ordered you to come and you came.
Right, that's right. Or certainly live with the impression that left on billions of people that
yeah.
that's what's happened. You know, one of the things that this like background for all of this, Trump, when we were at the Republican convention, talking to the people that attended there and, asking, these are the regular Republican constituents, the district leaders and, municipal officials, county officials and stuff that end up as the delegates to the national convention. And so these are people that have been going to Republican conventions and, working in Republican politics, some of them for decades. And, we know what the fruit of their work was up to that point. George Bush's father, Ronald Reagan, some of them further back, Ford, Nixon, and whatever. And we're looking at suddenly this massive amount of support for Trump among those people at the convention. So we're saying to them, listen, you chose this one or that one because of their stance on abortion or on gay marriage or on, whatever other social issues were really motivating for you and for your constituents. Trump is not of that orthodoxy, certainly, at all. And so what is it? And so, they were saying to us, look, we don't care about any of that. He said he's going to get us a job. So, the next line, I've said this much to you and to others before, but the next line was, of course, he's a politician. You can't possibly believe him. And the next line was, he's saying it. No one else is even saying it. They
exactly,
were told
exactly.
that those your job is gone.
Yeah, that's exactly
back.
Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. How did Trump win them? Because he acknowledged that these people have lost from globalization.
Right, exactly.
He's acknowledged that they've lost, which no other candidates will do, because as globalization was always seen by this neoliberal elite, be it the Democrats or the Republicans, certainly
right.
the Clintonites, as this great, wonderful driver of the world.
Right.
And you couldn't dare admit that people lost from it. Trump acknowledge that people lost from it,
right.
and he promised to try to do something about it.
Right.
And while I think that most of these people, at least some of them, acknowledge deep down somewhere that Trump is not going to be able to get their jobs back, that that's not going to happen, that nothing he do will, at least he's talking to them,
right,
and at least making a show of trying to do something about it, and that matters.
Right. Hey, at least I know you have a problem, And I'm telling you, I'm going to try to find a solution to it.
I don't think Trump has a solution,
right.
Because there I don't think there
be
are
one,
any
course.
Solutions.
Right.
But you can see where that would be far more compelling than,
right.
Hey, just re-educate yourself, move, learn to code, and move to the city.
Yeah,
right?
Right, exactly. Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, it's something else. And they're sending somebody into the room, they're at least saying, hey, I realize I'm going in as your agent, and I'm going to try to get you something, as opposed to like, thanks, see ya.
Especially now, since the Chinese and Indian and the Indians are now doing coding far better than they would as Americans anyway. Those jobs won't be available in the future anyway. So that is Trump's show with China, and Trump has other shows. The Trump Putin show is certainly top billing.
Right.
Putin said he's going to the G20 to address the international crises. I mean, he's talking about, you know, the possibility of U.S. attacks on Iran. He's talking about Syria with the U.S. occupation of East Syria still.
Right.
And he's talking about Venezuela with the U.S. still, you know, toying around what they can do to get rid of, you know, after their initial regime coups failed to try to get their man Guido, as Pompeo calls him, in power in Venezuela. So Putin will basically be providing backup to China. Right. You know, Russia's one of the you know, the top seven or eight biggest economies in the world by purchasing power parity, and will probably be back up among the top five in the next couple of years. But it's still nowhere near China and the U.S. league at this point. So Russia will be providing backup for China while courting Trump. I mean, that's the game that's going on.
Right.
And we saw that already they had a little sit down face to face meeting. U.S. journalists, are unhappy at seeing the U.S. president and the Russian president smiling at each other, furious at that, asked Trump whether he had told Vladimir Putin not to interfere with more terrible brainwashing Facebook posts or whatever in the next election. And Trump said, "You hear that, Vlad? Don't interfere in our elections." And they both laughed. And the press got even more furious.
Yeah. Right? Not just the press. You know, I'm looking at this tweet on Michael McFaul, who was the U.S. ambassador to Russia not so long ago. And he's, you know, disappointed. He said, "Disappointing, but expected." You know, not surprising, he said. Right.
They also made some comments about fake news. And he says, "You don't have a problem with that fake news in Russia." And Putin said, "Oh, we most certainly do. We have the same problem."
Yeah.
Right? Don't think that we don't have the problem. And the way every journalist outlet is treating that, right?
Right.
Is
two enemies
Trump,
of free speech.
Trump jokes to Putin they should get rid of journalists.
Right.
No, that's not what
they
said.
Of course,
that's not what they said at all. If you want to call yourself fake news, if you want to make that automatic association, well, be my guest, right? Without any defense of Trump and all of this, but it's really awful that the liberal mainstream media is so nasty and snarky and superior and condescending that they almost reflexively want to make you support Trump even when you don't.
I know it.
It's awful.
I know. It's almost like, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just hate both of them. So.
Yeah. I get like a voyeuristic thrill sometimes when he trumps one of them or another, just because for decades I've wanted to see somebody say to one of those characters, just one of them, as they lie across the spectrum, you're lying, and say it on television and have them have to carry it.
And it's true that Trump lies repeatedly, but so do you.
Yeah, right, that's right, exactly. You know, exactly. Only he's not supposed to be the courier of information to me.
At least we know it's entertainment.
Yeah, it is, exactly. That's right.
Also, the Trump-Erdogan meeting is actually going to be an important meeting as Turkey tries to squirm out of U.S. sanctions over purchasing Russia's S-400 air defense system. And U.S. tries to blackmail them over that, saying you won't get the F-35s, you'll never get – They're not saying you'll be kicked out of NATO, because they won't kick them out of NATO because they need them too much. But they'll try to hurt Turkey's military, and they'll also try to hurt Turkey's economy as punishment. Right.
Because that hurts Erdogan.
And Erdogan right now is facing some emergence of political threat, losing Istanbul to an combined opposition candidate recently. Yep. And Turkey's economy is not doing so well.
And in Turkish politics, losing Istanbul is like foreboding of some bad stuff for him.
It's an emergence. I wouldn't overplace it, because the in general the opposition is too divided,
right?
And the AKP's power is pretty solid on the identity issue, but they are vulnerable on economics and living standards, which is some possibility there. So the U.S. could threaten him there, and of course Russia will be keen to try to exploit any cracks and divisions between the U.S. and NATO and Turkey. That's part of what this game is all about. But the Trump-Erdogan meeting should also be important. But this is all Trump's show at the G20 itself. But like I said, it's a photo op. These important personal meetings that will then be used to drive, you know, the actual changes that come about in U.S. China policy, or U.S. Russia policy, or U.S. Turkish policy, or anything. But it's amusing. One of the key Japan is the president of the G20 now for the first time, and one of their key issues they wanted to focus on was G20's reaction to actions to climate change. I'm like, what a joke. I mean, you're hosting a U.S. president who doesn't even believe in climate change.
Right.
Just forget the agenda of the G20. It's all about the personal meet and greets and the photo ops and everything else. And that's we can gossip about, Trump and Putin sniggering together and how furious the journalists are. Trump and Xi's body language, what does that say to us? And so on. Oh, May made a nasty look when she was shaking Putin's hand. Unfortunately, that's really the most substance that actually occurs at these G20 meetings.
Right.
But while this is going on, and it's not without import, it's just not substantive.
That's
import.
Not the substance, right?
Putin gave a very long, in-depth, hour and a half exclusive interview to the Financial Times. Henry Foy was the one who conducted the interview.
28 pages.
Ooh. Yeah, it's huge, right? It's the article's name. The transcript's got a title: "All This Fuss About Spies, It's Not Worth Interstate Relations." Okay, the subtitle here is more important: "The Russian President on Globalization, China, Trump, and the End of the Liberal Idea." Right? It's Financial Times is behind a paywall generally, but this article is just behind a registration wall. So I seriously read this interview, register. You don't have to pay anything to register and read the article. Or they have a small clips of some important highlights, video highlights from the meeting as well. And the big thing that's coming out of this, the headline, the front page of the Financial Times, is Putin says liberalism is obsolete. The liberal idea is obsolete. And he does talk about everything in this interview. He talks a lot about foreign policy, about China, Russia-Chinese relations, Syria, the Skripal affair with the UK, the G20 itself, Iran, Venezuela. He talks about everything, really. Everything, really important. But in the end, he gets on to talking about how liberalism has outlived its purpose. And this is because the journalists asked him specifically about the wave of what they call populism.
Right.
I'm like, well, I'll accept the term populism as long as we agree that what you're promoting is elitism.
Right, you know, exactly.
I'm fine with that terminology as long as you accept mine.
I think we're going to have to wait till next week to get into this any deeper because we're pretty much out of time. But that'll be a good place to start next week because that is really the issue on the ground across much of the world right now.
And it plays back into that Trump phenomenon that we're all talking about.
Brexit,
Putin
all of
knows
that.
It
yep.
does.
Yep.
And when he's answering questions in this interview and saying this about liberalism,
right.
he is also courting Trump.
Right, that's right. All right, Mark, thank you very much. We'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks for having me again, Don. Can't wait till next week.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.